Welcome to the Christian Science Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Wednesday, June 5th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Sappenfield.
And I'm Molly Jackson.
When non-Muslims think of Islam, it's likely that they are thinking of an image largely crafted by Saudi Arabia. It is an image that Saudi Arabia has aggressively proselytized in the Sunni Muslim world and beyond through its wealth and influence, a strident conservatism that, for instance, only recently saw women as fit to drive. But this past week, that image showed signs of cracking. Outside the Muslim world, the disagreement might have seemed a small thing. Three Arab countries rejected Saudi Arabia's pronouncement that the holy month of Ramadan ended Tuesday. They proclaimed it ended Wednesday. But for correspondent Taylor Luck, that flicker of discord bespeaks something much bigger. Saudi Arabia is paying the price for politicizing religion. Saudi Arabia's interpretation of Islam, called Wahhabism, has been the country's main export the past four decades and was their attempt to expand and cement their influence across the Arab world, Taylor says. This reductionist or austere interpretation went unchecked until it invaded almost every major town and city in the Arab world. The fact that states are now showing they are willing to push back, albeit gradually, is a sign that Saudi's monopoly or unquestioned hegemony over Islam is not as secure as it once was, or as they think it is. For a religion that, in many places, is far more diverse and tolerant than the image of Wahhabism presents, it is the seed of a potentially powerful change. Today, our five stories include a look at Israel's moment of decision for democracy, Native Canadians' efforts to reforge the system that sought to break them, and an incomparable glance back at D-Day through the eyes and the cockpit of two pilots who lived it. Our first story. Impeachment is presented as a binary choice, but Congress has other options for dealing with perceived presidential offenses.
Now that retired special counsel Robert Mueller has spoken publicly about his Trump-Russia investigation, effectively leaving next steps to Congress, the question of impeachment has gained fresh urgency. The Mueller report found no provable conspiracy between Trump associates and Russia in the 2016 election, but it detailed 10 examples of potential obstruction of justice by the president. But Congress is not facing a binary choice, impeachment up or down. There are many options for responding to a president who defies subpoenas and whom a significant portion of Americans view as unfit for office. Among them is another form of sanction for perceived wrongdoing, censure, or a formal reprimand in the form of a majority resolution by one or both chambers of Congress. Unlike impeachment, which is the constitutional procedure for expelling a president before the end of his term, censure is not mentioned in the Constitution. But it's an option, rarely used, that would at least convey moral outrage over certain presidential actions. It's a symbolic gesture that would please no one, but it might be the best alternative, says a Democratic strategist speaking on Background. This story was reported by Linda Feldman in Washington for The Monitor.
Are elected leaders above the law? How crucial is an independent judiciary? Democracies worldwide are increasingly facing these questions. In Israel, they are at the center of concerns about Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's efforts to retain power.
Dan Meridor, a former justice minister who once worked closely with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, is among those warning of a threat to Israel's democracy. Mr. Netanyahu, who has three corruption cases pending against him, was attempting to gain immunity from prosecution while in office, and also give lawmakers power to override the Israeli Supreme Court. His 11th-hour maneuvers raised alarm bells among many in Israel, from the left and right, who saw in them an attempt to override democracy itself. The so-called immunity bill he sought is now on ice because the Knesset, led by Mr. Netanyahu's ruling Likud party, voted to dissolve and head to new elections rather than give opposition parties an opportunity to form a government, an audacious move without precedent in Israeli history. These developments have many in Israel worrying it is headed toward a diminished form of democracy. Pointedly, Israeli observers see what is happening here as very much part of the broader backlash against the post-World War II norms of liberal democracies around the globe. The courts, by definition, have a role in democracy, says Mr. Meridor. Limitless government is not democratic. This story was reported by Dina Kraft in Tel Aviv for The Monitor.
For generations, Native Canadians' own government treated them with appalling cruelty. So today, they are speaking out and making changes to a foster care system they say perpetuates old problems and thinking.
Although Canada's Indigenous population has more visibility in Canadian political and cultural life than America's, colonial policies have a dark history here. Traumas from assimilation policies from the 19th and 20th centuries have generated a lasting, vicious cycle. Generational issues often see Indigenous children born into more precarious family lives, yet those families become victims of a child welfare system built on centuries of stigma and bias. In British Columbia last year, of all children apprehended at birth, in which the government takes children from their mothers as a last resort protection, 55% were Indigenous. In the 2016 census, 5.9% of the province's population identified as Aboriginal. Authorities at the top recognize the challenge, but the Indigenous community says it's not enough. It is taking action now, helping to reclaim traditional cultural and family practices to try to break the cycle. A key feature is peer support by other Indigenous women who have fought to reunite their families. It's more about how we walk with you, and we call it companion care, says Patricia Dawn, founder of the Red Willow Women's Society. It's returning to and honoring that everybody has the right to dignity and respect. This story was reported by Sarah Miller-Yana in Duncan, British Columbia, for The Monitor.
Nearly 1 million children are out of school in Cameroon as a brutal separatist conflict wears on. 16-year-old Bless is just one. But his irrepressible love of learning underscores how war puts the potential of a generation and a country at risk.
When Awa Bless Chief led his hometown, he brought his most prized possessions, a set of electric toy cars. For years, the teenager has been teaching himself to craft the vehicles out of materials at the dump. A plywood tank whose gun barrel swivels 360 degrees, and a dump truck that lifts and deposits miniature cargo. Bless, now 16, dreams of attending university to become an engineer, a dream that was within sight just last year, in his hometown in Cameroon's northwest region. But over the past 3 years, a conflict between English-speaking separatists, who claim their community has long been marginalized, and the French-dominated government has become increasingly brutal. Bless and his older brother fled to his sister's home 6 hours away. For now, he's one of the 1 million Cameroonian children out of school. Schools have been frequent targets of separatist violence, seen as symbols of the state. After Bless started displaying his creations on the street, he's become a local hit, the budding engineer. But as flattered as he is, he can't help but think of what's missing. To be back in school, figuring out the science behind what makes each little vehicle go. This story was reported by Paul Gier in Douala, Cameroon, for The Monitor.
A 75th anniversary reenactment of D-Day is about more than history or getting to fly in cool planes. As a pilot says, it's about why we live free and the sacrifices that were made, and the incredible examples of what we can accomplish as a country when we all come together.
Lieutenant Colonel Dave Hamilton is dressed in a rumpled vintage uniform, but his memory is more than crisp. I'll be 97 in July. I'm a kid. He played a special role during D-Day as a 21-year-old pilot about to fly his first combat mission. Even before the main airborne assault, the kid from New York was part of an elite squadron of C-47s that left 6 hours before the main invasion. A squadron of 20 planes that dropped specialized Pathfinder troops behind enemy lines. What was it like to be sitting there in the cockpit, waiting to take off? He pauses. Maybe the word fear had never entered our minds, but we were anxious, he says. And we had our lives and the paratroopers' lives in our hands, until we dumped them out over France, and so it was somewhat of a relief to get rid of them, he says, kidding. I dropped my paratroopers at 1:15 in the morning. He went on to fly dozens more combat missions, including in the Korean War, when he flew more than 50 missions in an RB-26 bomber. Later, he trained to fly jets and served in the Air Defense Command, retiring from the Air Force in 1963. But I wasn't sure I was going to live through that first one, he says. I came back with over 200 bullet holes in that airplane. This story was reported by Harry Bruinius in Oxford, Connecticut, for The Monitor.
Now commentary on the future of capitalism from The Monitor's editorial board. This summer, the federal agency that regulates Wall Street will take a far-sighted move. It will hold a public roundtable to gather ideas on how to deal with short-term thinking in capital markets. Too many companies, says the U.S. Securities and Exchange Commission, need to foster a longer-term perspective. While financial experts differ on whether short-termism is getting worse, it is clear that many of today's problems, from climate change to global migration to aging societies, are so big and difficult that they require companies to resist investor pressure to give short shrift to the long view. Over the centuries, capitalism has contributed much to the universal welfare. The SEC now wonders if new regulations to discourage short-term thinking might improve that record. Specifically, the agency might allow companies to provide financial data only every 6 months instead of the current 3 months. The demand for a change is certainly there. According to SEC Chairman Jay Clayton, Americans who are building a retirement kitty in 401ks and IRAs want to know if their money will produce steady income over decades. This summer's roundtable will be an excellent forum to discover better ways to bring foresight and patience into American companies. That's a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thank you for joining us today. Please come back tomorrow when we ask the eternal question. Does the world really need another Pride and Prejudice remake? In the case of the novel Aisha at Last, yes. Drawing on her experience as a teacher in an educational program for migrants, today's Christian Science spiritual perspective contributor shares how self-righteousness, pride, and other elements that would keep us from bettering the world can be healed. You can find her story in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Jingnong Peng, Tim Malone, and Jeff Turton.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2019.